Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for the Beyond the Mekong series, which is published and broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today is Nick Ray, who is a well-known senior figure these days around Cambodia. He runs Hanneman Films with his wife. It's a family affair. And Nick's been well busy this year. Cambodia, it's struggled, particularly the economy, but Nick has been very busy keeping up with television, Hollywood, and international productions. Nick, welcome to the program.
Luke, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we've done it once or twice before, and it's good to be back. Something a little less controversial, but you've been busy.
Yeah, I've been quite busy, actually. There's been quite a lot of film and television interest in Cambodia.
Right.
It was obviously during the pandemic years, there was not much because people couldn't get in and they couldn't get out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say certainly in the last year or so, things have really taken off.
The main projects are Jackie Kennedy, Onassis, which I know there's a production going on with that one. I think, was it you who was reminded to add the Onassis to the end of her name? It was kind of created something of a small stir.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah, I hadn't heard, that wasn't me that was told about that part. But
right.
Yeah, 37 Heavens have been showing interest in Cambodia. Great mm-hmm. story. It's about her visit in 1967 to the temples of Angkor. This was, you know, obviously really moving moment for her, and she
yep.
was with a British diplomat who was an old friend of her husband's,
mm-hmm.
JFK, and there were rumours of an affair in the mystery
right.
of Angkor, against the shadow of Angkor. Nobody knows what really happened between the two of them, but this is sort of Hollywood's interpretation of what may have happened.
And of course, Cambodia's interpretation, well, it's always a little bit different, but if you go to Le Royale, on permanent display are the photographs from Jackie Kennedy's tour, and there's also those wine glasses where she's left her lipstick.
Obviously her lipstick.
Right, exactly. But I'm sure you've done the same thing, you know, have people coming to town, you take them to Le Royale, you have a couple of drinks and you say, have a look at this. And the reactions can be quite broad. Some people are like, oh, that's weird. And other people are like, wow, gee whiz. But
yeah.
She does stir the imagination still in this country.
Absolutely. And you look at those kind of iconic images of that 67 trip, they're pretty
mm-hmm.
amazing. You know, Sihanouk at the height of his pomp, amazing big open top American cars, the crowds.
Yep.
I mean, you know, when I was looking at locations for this project, you know, you start looking back at what Cambodia looked like in its heyday,
mm-hmm.
and pockets of that still exist in Phnom Penh.
Yep.
But if you want that kind of in a better preserved way, then of course you go somewhere like Battambang. You've got avenues and avenues of these amazing buildings.
Yeah, the provincial cities have still got quite a lot of charm.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of them have got either an old governor's residence that's
mm-hmm.
in great shape from the French period, or they've got blocks or rows of the old French shop houses. So
mm-hmm.
I think that's the trick is, you know, a film becomes a jigsaw puzzle of different locations that in the audience mind, it's one place, but we all know it's actually a composite.
Sure. Phnom Penh's getting harder and harder because there's, for these period pieces, because there's just so many skyscrapers that have
yeah.
gone up in the last 5 years. It's extraordinary.
That's to imagine. You'd have to do reverse CGI and
right.
remove the skyscrapers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's very expensive. Or you have to shoot extremely tight. So what we do on
mm.
low-budget TV productions, like
mm.
we've done quite a few episodes of Locked Up Abroad for National
right.
Geographic, and sometimes we've doubled Cambodia as Thailand, obviously. India, I think the most extreme one was somewhere like was it the Maldives? Yeah, we've done lots of places.
Sure.
And you've got to shoot extremely tight
yep.
to make Cambodia look like a desert island. But that's the thing. If you do it correctly, you can get away with it. So, for example, for the Jackie Kennedy shoot, if you were to do 37 Heavens here, you could certainly get away with, for example, around Wat Phnom, doing the sort of the big cavalcade coming into town. But again,
yep.
you'd have to have CDC in the background, remove the signage. It's a kind of military operation.
Nice and tight. Speaking of military operations, Banged Up Abroad. I've seen quite a few people I've known over the years turn up as bit part players in those series. At the same time, I think there's been one or two characters in there that I've known who were the subject of those.
Yeah,
have found themselves in deep, deep trouble. That series, it's been going a long time, and how have you found dealing with the characters and
yeah.
the people involved?
No, it's one of the most popular series on Nat Geo. It's been one
yeah.
of their headline shows for a long time. I think in the UK it's called Banged Up Abroad,
mm-hmm.
but obviously in the US that has a different meaning.
Yes, indeed.
So it's Locked Up Abroad. So I always have to remember what to call it.
Right.
But no, it's we've done, I think, about 5 or 6 episodes now over the years, and we've had sort of luminaries from Phnom Penh such as Derek Mays was in it once upon a time. Dave Potter has been in it.
David Potter and Derek Mays, for those who don't know, have been long-standing stalwarts in the Cambodian business community for quite a while. It's amazing how many of them would like to be in television.
But easily typecast as rogues.
I hope they're listening.
But no, it's been very interesting because I think what happens is they spend a lot of time interviewing the subject. So they find somebody that's willing to tell their story, and it's a lot of long, long master cam interviews. Talk, extract every story, every bit of information. And then where we come into it as Cambodia and Hanuman Films is we have to recreate those stories visually. So it may be the prison, it may be the trial, it may be the arrest, it may be the crimes, it may be the drugs. But we have to piece together the story of what happened to them using locations in Cambodia with maybe one main actor from the US or the UK, but then everybody else wannabe actors from Cambodia.
Oh, welcome abroad. with 37 Heavens and Banged Up Abroad, and I know you're working on several other productions as well, how have you found dealing with the Cambodian authorities? And also, given that you're shooting in India and Thailand as well, what are the differences in terms of the difficulties getting these projects off the ground and actually filming on site?
Yeah, I mean, I think Cambodia is very open to filming. You know, obviously, having worked in most of the neighbours, the thing is, Cambodia doesn't have as many projects as some of its bigger neighbours, but actually, it's very straightforward to move things forward. I mean, you get your permissions from the Ministry of Culture and Fine Arts. Right. They're very open-minded. I mean, it's a bit more sensitive if certain topics, obviously, you know, the Khmer Rouge or trafficking or things like that would obviously raise more interest and more concerns. But generally speaking, they're very open to most content, you know, that's obviously not controversial. So, you know, we've done TV shows on ancient history of Angkor, lots of challenge shows like, you know, the Amazing Race, the Race Across the World, those kind of things. And I'd say, you know, you can get all your permissions done within a calendar month, which if you compare that to, say, Vietnam and Thailand, that's pretty amazing.
Right.
So that's good going. And I think the thing is, hopefully, with the new direction of the government and an interest in filmmaking and wanting to put themselves on the map, I think it's a case of understanding not just the importance of the film industry and what that can generate locally in jobs and opportunities. It's about the impact that the films made here can have globally. You look at Tomb Raider as the great example, you know, that was 25 years ago, and tour guides are still talking about it every day at Ta Prom Temple and the Tomb Raider tree, and telling always the wrong stories about Angelina Jolie, but what the hell? But the point is, it has an impact. Now, you imagine that's one movie that's been in Cambodia. Thailand gets maybe 5 or 10 movies of a similar scale almost every year. So imagine the sort of the huge marketing campaign that is for a destination.
And it has been a bit of a Hollywood favourite. Angelina Jolie, as you mentioned, Matt Dillon shot City of Ghosts here, which I thought was a terrific film. It seems to be a movie that gets edited and re-edited every 5 years, and the latest edition is fantastic. It's very tight.
I need to watch that again. I haven't seen the re-edit, the master edit.
Exactly. Matt Dillon came out here for the 20th anniversary, I think it was, last year. There has been quite a good deal of interest in Cambodia, given it's not Thailand, it's not Vietnam, it's a lot smaller, and it's got this history which outsiders, for want of a better word, they like to play on the stereotypes. And Cambodia has a bit more to offer than the slaughterhouses of the Civil War and intense poverty that really did exist here. But it has improved enormously over the past 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's moved on massively, and I think that's where also the narrative needs to move on. Mm-hmm. But I think also, you know, it's also a case for the government learning to be a little bit less sensitive about the content of a film.
Right.
Because, for example, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a story about Cambodia. It could be a story anywhere, and the content could be anything. You're offering your country as a location. It's not necessarily your story. You imagine if the US government got sensitive about all the movies that show, like, mass shoot-ups, mass robberies, mass killings in American cities.
Well, it happens. Clint Eastwood has been turned it into a genre.
Exactly. Imagine that. That's it. Sort of Dirty Harry. And that, yet those are amazing films and iconic, and they're seen for what they are, entertainment. And I think that would be a useful thing for the younger generation of leadership here now to look at is, hang on, yeah, this is simply a form of entertainment. It's storytelling. Let's allow them to use, you know, this palette that is Cambodia with these amazing locations to tell a story.
If someone comes in, say, with a $10, $20 million budget, I'm not sure what the budgets are these days. I'm under the impression they've come down dramatically, as has costs in terms of production costs, cameras, and, you know, the high-tech wizardry kind of thing. But you can't come into a country, okay, you've got all the permissions, and then be told by the government what you're going to put in it. It's not going to happen.
No, exactly. People want places where they can tell their story in their own way. Mm. I mean, a good example of a low-budget film that was shot here that not many people necessarily know about, but was a really interesting film, was it's called Monsters of Man, and it was done by New Zealand-Australian filmmaker Mark Toyer, who sadly passed away last year from cancer, but really great filmmaker, very visionary, shot a huge number of commercials all around the world, very in-demand commercial maker, but always wanted to make a movie. And this was like a cross between Terminator and Predator, you know, so it was like robot gone wrong in the jungles of Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was kind of known to be Cambodia in the story, but it wasn't too sensitive because it was nothing to do with politics. It was just literally American test robots gone AWOL. Yep. And a lot of it was shot in Phnom Kulen in Siem Reap, you know, beautiful location, you know yourself. And a lot of it in the back streets of Phnom Penh, really gritty. But, you know, he managed to bring that in. I can't remember the full budget because I only know bits and pieces of it, but I'm sure he brought it in at just a couple of million, you know, very few million, which, you know, it actually looks really good. You know, you watch the trailer, great robots, great special effects. He had all the actors with all their patches on doing their things. So, you know, if you've got the will and you want to keep the cost down and it's your own money, then you can make it happen.
Well, I think it was Steven Spielberg, a friend of mine quoted him once. He was talking to George Lucas, I think it was, whether it was Star Wars or Indiana Jones, but he referred to OPM, other people's money. Yeah. That's where the investors are.
That's so true.
Also, there's a lot of spin-off effects for the local film industry. Is it Fight Club? Not Fight Club.
Jailbreak.
Thank you. Yes, Jailbreak. But I thought Jailbreak was a fantastic movie. Low budget. Shot in totally in Cambodia, basically one set, which was a prison.
Yeah.
But that did very well as also.
Yeah, I think what's going to be interesting for Cambodia is how, you know, where we struggle a little bit is population size.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 16.5 million.
Yep.
For somebody like Netflix or Amazon or Apple, that's a small audience.
Right.
They're looking at Indonesia, you know, 250 million. They're looking at, you know, Vietnam, 100 million. Yep. The Philippines, 100 million. So they're starting to do very localized or regional content. So they're doing content in Vietnamese, they're doing content in Bahasa, they're doing content in Tagalog, but they haven't yet done much in Khmer because, you know, they're not going to get as many subscribers and as much impact. But that would be the next step, is when they start to see the interest in, you know, televising whatever it may be, a series about, rest in peace, King Sihanouk, or whoever it may be. But, you know, some
kind of kickboxing.
Yeah,
I'm sure that's coming.
Exactly. So there's lots. We know there's no shortage of stories here. But it's, as you said, it's finding the money and the investors that want to tell those stories, not just on a local platform for Cambodian cinema, but actually for a larger international platform.
What type of budgets are you generally looking at, say, for a Netflix flick or a Hollywood feature?
So I know with First They Killed My Father, that was a budget of about 15 million, which is relatively low, you know, for an Angelina Jolie project.
Right.
Normally her fees, because she was behind the camera, not in front, it was a lot cheaper. I think it would, you know, it was probably her regular fee might be 5 million and up. Maybe for directing, she only charged half a million, as it was one of her early films. But anyway, that aside, yes, basically, you know, I think Hollywood, a low budget, as soon as you mention Hollywood, a low budget Hollywood film might be somewhere between 5 and 10 million.
Yep.
And then the average medium budget film is probably somewhere from 10 to 50 million. And then it gets into the territory of, you know, big movies when you're 50 million and up.
What's the demand these days for documentaries?
Like feature documentaries, I think very interesting. You look at the kind of viewership on those platforms, very, very strong.
I'm hearing that back in vogue. I mean, I've seen... Yeah. I've been a part of making documentaries. I've got friends in the business. Over the last 20 years, it's gone up and down like a yo-yo, and it's like, oh, and then it's like, oh no, things are picking up, and then, oh, and it just...
I think there's definitely the really strong ones will always sell, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, Searching for the Sugar Man, those kind of stories, that the big ones. But the other thing that's interesting now is obviously things like true crime genre, you know, that's become very big.
Yes.
Solving unsolved crimes, mm-hmm. you know, using technology, DNA and so on. So there's been whole programs where somebody sets off on a journey to discover what happened to their father, sibling or whoever. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a documentary with a resolution at the end. So I think the thing, again, platforms have opened this up because it's about people's taste. So, and if something gets a good review or people start telling their friends, you've got to watch this, it's amazing, actually that travels pretty quickly.
Yeah, I was talking to a couple of filmmakers here the other night, Nico Mesterham at Meadowhouse, yep. Who you know, and David Brown. And I guess we're heading into territory where it's going to get wild and woolly, in the sense that often you can make a movie which... with unintended consequences. You know, it's a movie that you don't think will have much of a run or won't have great success, but then it just hits the right note.
Yeah.
And kaboom, it's sort of... Jailbreak, I think, was one of those.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's what can happen. It's finding the right audience for the story. And I think, going back to documentaries, that the challenge was particularly in cinemas. They were never very compatible with cinemas, so very few long feature documentaries made it to cinemas, whereas platforms have given them that voice, and people actually don't just want to watch something kind of saccharine and throwaway and unbelievable. They want to go, what can I get my teeth into? Where's a real story?
I was talking to... a Hollywood producer whose name will remain out of the conversation. Not that long ago, I'm not name dropping, but we're talking about producing an hour and a half feature length, what it would take to do something out of Burma, which of course is difficult.
Yeah.
We know how to get access to stock footage. We can get B-roll, no problems. But the whole point was his emphasis on bums on seats. There are streaming platforms, there are educational platforms where you can move this sort of genre. Because at the end of the day, he would say, this is great footage, oh, we like that. And I'm like, well, we can't just call one of our stringer filmmakers and say, oh, look, we heard they're going to bomb over here in a week or two. Do you mind popping over there and just get, you know, it doesn't work like that. And the security and safety of staff is always paramount, but I just felt that it got lost with that bums on seat mentality.
Yeah, I mean, it's two things, really. You either need bums on seats to pay for the return on investment for all those investors, or you need to get your money up front, you know. So you either get the investors in advance with getting TV channels that want to support it, you know, BBC or whoever it may be, Channel 4, or if you haven't got that, you get your big names in and then you've got to reap it back afterwards. But ultimately, yeah, even if it's a passion project, you've got to have your bottom line in the picture. You know, you don't want to spend months or years of your life making this amazing documentary, but then at the end of the day, you're bankrupt.
I can think of one or two documentary makers. Dare I say it, Stanley Harper was one who spent an enormous number of years, I think it was like 15, making a documentary. He started out on UNTAC, which then progressed to... the impact of AIDS in Cambodia. But by the time it came out, AIDS wasn't even a story anymore. The caravan had moved on.
Yeah, that's so true. No, exactly. So that's the thing as well, is the longevity of a project, the shelf life. It's, I mean, you know, our very personal experience of all of this was The Last Reel, which was not a documentary. Yeah, that's a feature film. But that was a journey in itself. I mean, the thing that taught us, because... say, The Last Reel was made in 2013-14.
Yep.
And was then shown at film festivals and cinemas in 2014-15-16.
Right, and it was very much driven by your wife, Kulika, if I remember correctly.
She was the director, and I worked as an executive producer, did locations, but it took a whole team to bring it together. And it did very well. I mean, it was given the Spirit of Asia Award at the Tokyo International Film Festival. Michael Moore, the Oscar-winning director, gave it his Founders Grand Prize at Traverse City Film Festival.
Oh, lovely.
So it scooped about 10 awards and critically very well received as a Cambodian told story, not a foreigner telling the story, an actual Cambodian telling the story. But it's the process was so challenging, because what we'd done for many years before that, going back to Tomb Raider, is help other people to make films. Now, there's a big difference between servicing and producing. Servicing is helping everyone else get the permissions, do the logistics, book the hotels, secure the locations. They're all tricky things, but then they pack up and leave, and the post-production is on them. What we learned is the post-production is a nightmare, and it can drag on and on and on, and it can be extremely costly because you've got to sometimes re-edit things, you've got to reshoot things when
that's
it doesn't add up.
If
the cuts don't add up and the timeline's wrong, a bit of a reshoot. Sound, if the sound's bad, soundtrack, musical score. I mean, the list goes on.
Yeah, I've always found, in terms of filmmaking, my limited experience, it's the audio. You get a group of filmmakers together, they're not talking about cameras or film, they're talking about audio, because a film can pass muster even if the pictures aren't great. But if the sound quality is crap, you immediately lose the audience. And the talk of microphones and kind of these sorts of things has always been, it's always top of the agenda.
No, it's very true. Sound, I mean, you know, you've been on sets, whether it's television or whatever, and the sound recordist, they're a very important part of it. And, you know, the director will always be checking with the sound recordist how happy they are, have they got it. And, you know, the kind of things that trip them up in Cambodia are most unexpected, but it could be construction sites, as we heard
earlier. Which, so you've given me the segue for that one. Just to inform the audience, we are sitting about 50 metres from behind the North Korean embassy, which appears to be undergoing renovations. The roof has been torn off as we speak, but there's not much I can do about that. It's only about 20 metres away.
That's so. It, and it's like traffic noise. The one that always gets them in Angkor, Temples of Angkor, is cicadas. You know, the cricket type insect, because they kick off when it gets hot after about midday, and it's like this super pitched whine, you know,
the loud
screeching, and the sound guys are just like, oh, the horror. So it, you know, simple things, but sound is very important, and sound syncing and sound levels, and obviously, you know, some directors deal with it very differently, and how the way they like to do things.
Is there anyone you would not work with again?
Ooh, that's a very interesting question. So far it's all been pretty okay. I mean, okay, I'll just give you some examples of reputation, shall we say. So I was lucky enough, in inverted commas, to work on Top Gear Vietnam, the famous show when they did the motorbikes from Saigon to Hanoi. And then Ha Long Bay, we turned them into amphibious. And so a Vespa became a paddle steamer. The Minsk became like a pedalo, and the Honda Cub became a skiff, like a sort of Southeast Asian boat. But Jeremy Clarkson has a very bad reputation.
Yes, he does.
Among some people, I mean, he punched a producer and got fired from the BBC. He's quite controversial. He was quite interesting to work with. I wasn't a fanboy. I mean, I thought Top Gear was quite a good show, and I don't necessarily agree with all his politics, but very interesting character, very, very funny, and very, very clever. Normally, a producer and or a director would come up with all those beats and lines and ideas for the whole show. No, that was Jeremy on a family holiday. His notebook, he comes up with the whole plan. So he's not just a producer, and he's certainly not just a pretty face.
Right, no, he's that's... Another producer in town the other day, Sean Ramsey, who's got his own Hollywood connections, but I asked him, how is the film industry going? And he said, it's not an industry. I'm like, what do you mean by that? I think he was quite right, actually. It's like, imagine you've got a group of people. One person is a set designer, which means he's a carpenter and a painter and he's in the union. Another guy does lighting, someone does sound. Cameramen don't really care who's out there, but they'll get the shot. And then you've got a producer who's the money man, one director who's trying to tell everybody from all these different industries where to go, and in the centre is a diva.
That's a great way of putting it.
And dealing with divas is not always easy.
No, it's not. I mean, obviously, we've dealt with a few famous actors over the years. So, Tomb Raider was Angelina Jolie, Daniel Craig at the very beginning of his career. We've dealt with people like Guy Pearce on Two Brothers. We've dealt with a lot of TV personality, Gordon Ramsay, etc. I don't know. I mean, I've found myself that it's always been fine, but that's because the way I've always approached it is I just act normally with them.
Right.
And I feel that in their world, they're always put on a pedestal or a throne even. You know, they're always raised up and people basically kowtowing to them the whole time. So I just treat them as human beings And, you know, I always, the way I go into the exchange is they need us as much as we need them.
Yep.
They have no idea about Cambodia, no knowledge of the culture, no knowledge of how things work. Yep. So, you know, this is a fair exchange. Just act normal.
With people like Angelina Jolie, who has helped out enormously with the villages up in the Sam Lot. And when she came here for one of the Cambodian film festivals, she was still married to Brad Pitt and they were both here. Some of my former students were working directly with her. They spoke wonderfully well of her. They said she was terrific. And it's not always full of, the low expectations that Hollywood can bring with it sometimes.
No, exactly. I mean, as you say, she's, you know, she obviously formed a very strong emotional bond with the country through the adoption of Maddox.
Yeah.
You know, Cambodia has become something very important to her, part of her soul, if you like, her DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And that project in Sam Lot, the Maddox Jolie Pip or Maddox Jolie Foundation,
right,
maybe it's been truncated.
It started well before Brad Pitt came
exactly.
along.
But she's done a really good job there. I've been out there actually. Yeah. So one interesting project I worked on in 2019 was Guerlain, the perfume from France, Mont Guerlain.
Yep.
So she's the face of Guerlain. So she wanted the commercial to be shot in Cambodia, and not just Cambodia, in Sam Lot at her place.
Yeah, and I have been out there. I have been out to her place, and it is a long... This was, God, it was 25 years ago. Has it changed much? I mean, the access roads were atrocious. There was a lot of landmines. It was the poor of the poor.
Yeah, I mean, because it's an ex-Khmer Rouge area, so it was really, really in a very degraded way. It's improved a lot. So the access now, there's tarmac down to all the way to Pai Lin, and when you turn off from Pai Lin, go further south towards Sam Lot, mostly surfaced, a few bumpy bits.
Yep.
The main development was, which was interesting from our scouting, was if you remember that when she did First They Killed My Father, she was the first guest to check into Phum Bai Thong, the luxury five-star resort on the outskirts of Siem Reap.
Yep.
Her and Brad and family did a kind of buyout on it, which is a great start for a hotel. She loved the architecture so much, she commissioned the Australian architect to build her a Malaysian-style longhouse home at the Sam Lot location.
Then it's changed.
No.
When I was there, it was, beaten down weatherboards and the survivors of a very nasty war.
Nice. And there's now a boutique house at the back. The front is very nice project buildings and everything where the staff are. You go through to the back and there's this amazing private house. And I went there with, I believe, a good friend of yours, Roland Neveu, photographer from 1975, The Fall of Phnom Penh.
Yep.
He and I scouted her house and it was all a little bit embarrassing because we were actually in the house before she'd been there. So the architect had finished and the interior designers were about to come in and there was a little window in the middle where Roland and I spent a day there taking pictures and notes.
Location, location, location.
Exactly.
That's the way it's going. How are things shaping up for 2025? There's not a lot of money around, but there does seem to be budgets for productions seem reasonably healthy.
Yeah, I mean, with films, you've always got to be careful because Cambodia is sort of quite a long way down the list, sadly, still. So, you know, there's films being made, but they're being made all over the world, not necessarily here. What we find is there's a lot of television interest. So we're talking to productions from the UK, Sweden, the US, lots of challenge shows, lots of game shows. We just did, and I can say this now, I would have been shot if I'd said it about 3 weeks ago.
Right.
We did one of the biggest shows in the Netherlands in June and July called Wie is de Mol? Who is the Mole? And it's a cross between Amazing Race and Traitors. And so the production has somebody on the inside scuppering all the other contestants.
Right, and that's like the film industry itself. I mean, I remember... mid-late last year, I think we were each working on competing projects in regards to Gary Glitter. And we were with Minnow Films and the final production screened across the UK on ITV in April. It went very, very well and it was a very difficult production to work on because the subject matter is a pedophile.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not looking forward to reviews that say, great work, this is a fantastically entertaining film, you know. But I was quite impressed by the critics because most of the critical praise all centered around one word, chilling. which I think summed it up pretty well. But it was interesting. I think we were bypassing each other. It's like, I'm working on this.
That's so funny you bring that up, because yes, the one that we worked on still hasn't come out yet. It's a three-part series for Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And again, because it hasn't come out yet, I can't say too much, but it has been, I can talk about the bits that have been mentioned in press releases.
Yep.
It's more about the journalists that covered the story.
Oh, that's a good story.
So yeah, for you as a journalist, it's the story of the people that scooped it. So it's the Red Tops in the UK and things like that. It's the people that staked him out.
Yep.
Rooftop Ray, they called him, not me. Not Nick Ray. And it's the story of them coming back to revisit after all these years and look back on, you know, what they found and how they uncovered it, and the kind of way they, how they worked, the modus operandi in those days.
It was difficult because I'd come back from Iraq, found out he'd been here for 6 months, and I was one of the first people to actually write the story that he was here. And then it was all about finding him. And I remember other journalists were annoyed with me because I was working for a wire service, so I wrote the story. And then everybody has it. But they're like, don't do that. Don't write that. Because if you write that, we won't have it as an exclusive. And we had a lot of journalists who didn't make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And those journalists were being suckered in by what was left of Fleet Street. And they're all offered big bucks to go out and find Gary Glitter. And it was just a mess. And in the end, he scuppered anyway, off to Vietnam and into prison.
Yeah. But it is interesting because, again, we shouldn't go too much down the glitter trail.
Right.
You know, the fact that he on and off may have spent 4 or 5 years here, you know, between the first time he was sighted in 1999 and then finally left in 2005.
Yep.
We're not saying he was here all the time. He was moving between other countries. But it's amazing that he could come in and out sort of, you know, phantom-like.
Yeah.
And he obviously, was, you know, he knew the country well, was comfortable here and...
Wouldn't go away.
Wouldn't quite go away, you know.
Anything else up for grabs next year?
I think there's you know, the things that are always interesting. There's always Hanuman Films projects, our own projects, you know, the producing rather than the servicing. And I think Kulika's got a few things in the pipeline. So she's working on a rice documentary. She's working on something with the Japanese and Tokyo Film Festival. So, you know, there's always things bubbling away. It's trying to get the time and the focus to make them happen.
Right. So for an industry that doesn't really exist, that's just a bunch of people who get together and say, hey, let's make a movie. Things aren't that bad.
Things aren't that bad. And Cambodia is one of the best places on earth to film. If only the authorities could make that more clear. We just need to market ourselves better.
On that note, Nick Ray, thank you very much. Been a lovely chat, as always.
Thank you so much, Luke.
Okay, cheers, mate.